This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. A little hippo named Fiona captured the attention of the world, putting the Cincinnati Zoo on the global stage. But even before and after Fiona came along with her irresistible presence on social media, lots of important work was and is taking place at the zoo. Director Thane Maynard joined us earlier to talk about it. Our guest now is the director of the Cincinnati Zoo, Thane Maynard. You hear him regularly on his 90-second naturalist segment here on 91.7 WVXU and 90.9 WGUC. Thane, thanks for coming in.
Michael, thanks. It's fun to be here with you.
Yeah, I'm thrilled to meet you and to talk a little bit about the zoo. And we know the zoo is planning to have a major expansion in the coming years, and we're going to talk about that. But first, just in general terms, a lot of places have zoos, right? All these cities have zoos.
Yeah.
But we have the Cincinnati Zoo. And why does that make us special?
You know, it's an interesting question because it is true. There's about 200 accredited zoos in North America, and many of those towns, I would say more than 100, deeply believe they have one of the top zoos in the country because people just love their hometown zoo. So that's not just San Diego or Disney's Animal Kingdom or the Bronx, those really big zoos. That's true in Akron. That's true in Toledo. That's true in Topeka. People love their hometown zoo. Now, that said, you know, not every town is a zoo town, just like not every town's a football town. Well, thankfully, Cincinnati is a zoo town. You know, we now are the biggest draw annually in the city of Cincinnati, biggest draw in Hamilton County, biggest year-round draw. We do draw less attendance than Kings Island, but they're only open 6 months of the year. And we're open every day. So, you know, for a town like ours that often has bad weather, we're not a tourist town. That makes us certainly one of the overachievers of the zoo business. So I think part of our success is we don't say, oh, boo-hoo, we don't have enough land. Oh, boo-hoo, we're in this. We're like, hey, come on, let's do it. And on lots of levels, we're a leader in zoo education, a national leader, and have long been. We're broadly known as the greenest zoo in America for all our sustainability work. Our CREW program, which is our Center for Conservation and Research of Endangered Wildlife, is really a leader in science and conservation. We're the zoo that figured out how to breed Sumatran rhinos, and we're among the few who have not given up on them. We sent our last two that were born at the zoo to live in Sumatra, and Dr. Terry Roth, who runs our program, who's the world's expert on rhinos, goes over twice a year, and we're working with people in the national parks there to try to save that species. Many people have given up. They say, oh, it's going to go extinct, but they said that about the condor, too, and the condors are back.
Wow. So, I mean, that's a lot of stuff going on in one facility, and something to be proud of for sure. So I would be remiss if I didn't bring up a certain hippo, and I know we got to get into
some. Exactly.
I can't wait to talk to you about like the LEED certification and the expansion plans and all that, but let me just jump right on Fiona, if I can, because this little hippo, which is now a big hippo,
that's right,
is quite a sensation. She's everyone's favorite hippo. She was born 6 weeks premature.
She was, yeah, 2 years ago.
At the zoo. Now counted as the smallest hippo ever to survive.
That's right. No one had ever raised a premature hippo. They normally are very precocious. You know, they're 100 pounds. They're like a giant slippery watermelon. They're born underwater. They nurse underwater. They climb on their mother's back all on the day they're born. In her case, she looked like a little deflated football, laying in the straw, lifeless. I thought, holy cow. But through never giving up, and lots of fits and starts. I mean, the first day, it's hilarious to look back. We said, all right, well, and we sent people all over town to try to buy the largest breast pumps we could find. Well, a breast pump's not going to work on a hippo. Nobody ever milked a hippo. We're like, just trying. Eventually, one of the scientists from our research program CREW, who happened to be fairly petite, slipped underneath Bibi, the mom. You know, the hippos are very dangerous, but it's kind of slipped underneath and was able to milk her into a Tupperware container. And we gave half of the milk to Fiona so she got some of her mother's antibodies. We sent the other half to the National Zoo in Washington, where they have the National Milk Repository, which is the largest collection of wild animal milk in the world. They have whale milk, they have mouse milk, all kinds of things. And now they have hippo milk. But they were able to determine that hippo milk is very high in protein and very low in fat compared to, say, human milk, which is very high in fat and very low in protein. So basically, we made gallons and gallons and gallons of formula for about 9 months to feed Fiona, but she got after it pretty good. And yeah, she's over 1,000 pounds now.
And you said no one before had ever milked a hippo?
It's a hard thing to do. You know, A, just their build, it's not an easy thing to do. And, you know, a hippo's a tough animal. They kill more people than any other animal in Africa.
That's a little known fact.
And it's hard to train them to sit still while you nurse them, but they will do anything for food. So this involved a keeper on one hand feeding Bibi melon, which is her favorite, and the scientist reaching underneath to nurse, laying down on the floor, and then another keeper holding her legs in case, Bibi moved and just yank her out of there. But it did work, and that's a great example of a lot of the things that went into saving Fiona.
I don't think I knew that background story. So how do you prepare for those situations that might come up? I mean, you run a zoo, so you deal with a lot of different animal situations. But on this particular day, here you were dealing with a prematurely born baby hippo and needing to milk an adult hippo.
Well, as you can imagine, the zoo has a very strong animal care program and an animal health program. We have professional keepers. We have veterinarians, veterinary technicians. For any animal that we know is coming, whether that's, say, a giraffe, and, you know, you've got 15 months to prepare for it, or a gorilla, you know, we will have a birth plan. And we'll say, all right, here's what we're going to try to do when that baby comes, and here are all the steps, and what do we do with the vets, et cetera. But, of course, a lot of times things never go according to plan, and the plan goes out the window. In this case, looking at it ahead of time, if someone had said, all right, look, you're going to have a little baby. She's going to be one-third body weight. She's going to be lifeless. You would just say, well, that's a shame, but that's not going to work. Partly because normally she would be born even in a zoo underwater. We wouldn't even know. She would have drowned. But Bibi was a first-time mom. Fiona was born up on the dry area. And one thing led to the next. So part of it was, no matter what, just like with a human baby, we had to keep her warm. So those stories got to be hilarious. For months, not just keepers, but other volunteers throughout the zoo, what we called Team Fiona, would stay with her 24/7 when she was little, spend the night, lay with her, hold her, and keep her warm. We kept her in what was the bathroom area of the hippo barn because it had a heated floor and was the warmest part of the building with no windows or outside doors. It was 98 degrees in there. So imagine, as charming as Fiona is, sleeping overnight in a room that's 98 degrees, laying on the floor. The floor is heated. You've got this hot, wet hippo next to you. I mean, you got to really want to save a hippo to do that night after night.
For sure. Wow, what a great story. So the enthusiasm for Fiona and the public is obvious. But like from a business standpoint, of the business of the zoo and in your line of work, what has the success of Fiona, both in health and in entertainment, because she's got books and web series and product placement. What has all that meant for the zoo?
Well, she has really been the only animal we've ever had who's paid her own way, right? Because every business I can think of, you know, Grater's made an ice cream, Mirkwood Pottery made special Christmas ornaments and medallions and steins.
I think she's going to guest host this show soon,
exactly,
actually.
Exactly, I know. Well, it's cute. The New York Times put her on the cover full page of the style section when she was about 6 months old. And the reporter who came was just like you'd expect from New York, very snazzy, you know, dressed in black, went to Stanford. And I said, but the style section? And she looked at me aghast and she said, Fiona is a celebrity.
Wow.
Like Beyonce. She only needs one name.
Whoa.
Now, Fiona loved that. I bet Beyonce might not, but there you go.
Wow. So you can pretty much post any photo or video of Fiona and get the type of social media reach that other brands and businesses would just beg for. So what impact on the zoo's communication strategy and social media strategy has Fiona had?
She has accelerated what was already going on, and you've probably seen this in all the media you're involved with. 20 years ago, the zoo used the big ad agency style, spent a ton of money. If we were going to shoot, say, a video to do a TV, we'd hire an outside group, we'd have catering, we'd do all kinds of things. You know, we'd also sit around and say, I don't know, should we run a black and white ad in the paper or a color ad? Well, that whole world has changed, right? You reach more people as soon as you type something out on your phone and send it on Instagram than you'd ever reach spending all the money I just mentioned. So we now use sort of small agency style and do a lot of that production ourselves. We have an in-house videographer, Pat Story, who I've worked with for years, used to be chief photographer at Channel 5. We have an in-house art department. And you know, we keep it simple. When you see a zoo billboard, almost always there's a picture of an animal and the word zoo, and then there might be other little taglines, but pretty much the animal and zoo covers it. Every three-year-old in America knows what the word zoo is. So, you know, we don't want to blow that. We've got a great brand.
That's perfect. So are you able to gauge which animals tend to be more popular? Because obviously Fiona's not the only animal you've got over there at the zoo. Which animals tend to be more popular with guests and your online following? Like, I love the otters. Mm-hmm. I love anytime you guys post pictures of the otters. So they've grown on me rather rapidly. I love those pictures. They seem to be like a perfect mix of cute and mischievous, which I think is fun. Mm-hmm. You've got aardvarks. Mm-hmm. You've got rhinos. You've got animals of different sizes. And at the risk of editorializing, different levels of cuteness as well. But what seems to be the main factor for an animal to become popular?
Well, there's an old adage in the zoo business, which is mammals pay the bills, right? So people do want to see large mammals, active mammals, like when you said the otters, right? If the otters just slept and they were laying there, you'd say, well, that's kind of an interesting weaselly looking thing, right? But because they're running all around, they're eating fish, they're swimming, they're playing with each other, and then you're intrigued by it. That's some of the popularity of monkeys, for instance. Often they'll live in groups. They're very active. They actually act like our families. You know, the youngsters bug the older ones, and they all jump and chase each other. So you've got large mammals. You've got big predators. You've got active mammals. But beyond that, you know, the mission of the zoo is to inspire people with wildlife and also show biodiversity. So our zoo actually has more bird species and more bird individuals than we do mammals. Wow. We also have lots of reptiles, amphibians, fish. We even have insects. Our insectarium was the very first anywhere. It opened in 1978. So by getting so many people to come to the zoo, we expose them to more than just, say, our animal show or our cheetah run. They get to learn a lot about how nature works.
We're talking with Thane Maynard. He's the director of the Cincinnati Zoo. It's about to undergo a major expansion. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. I was scrolling through the list of animals that you have on the Cincinnati Zoo mm-hmm. website, and I spotted the screaming, hairy armadillo.
Absolutely.
Yeah, this was a kind of weird looking little fella. And then as I stared at him at first being sort of scared, and then he kind of grew on me. He's like, you know what? He's kind of cute too. So this guy's part of your educational program. So which animals are part of that and how are they used?
Sure. Well, screaming hairy armadillos, we also have three other species of armadillos, are great animals that you can take out. Kids can touch them. We have an outreach program that goes to schools. We have huge programs within the zoo for zoo camp and things like that, as well as what we call our Wild Encounters program. If people are real familiar with the zoo and have been over time, they've seen a change over the last decade or so where the zoo is much more active than it once was. Historically, just like museums are, I think, people historically we'd walk through and there might be something going on or not, or, oh gosh, there's a sleeping rhino and there's a sleeping hippo. Instead, trying to say, okay, we're not a tourist town. We want people to come back. And the way that works is not telling them to come back or not advertising, but having them say, man, that was fun when we were at the zoo. We ought to go back over there. And so we have lots of those handleable sorts of animals, whether those are small mammals like armadillos or sloths. They can be reptiles such as snakes and alligators. They could be birds. Walking around the grounds, you might have seen where we walk our whole flock of flamingos through, or this time of year in the winter, we'll walk our penguins on a penguin walk twice a day, giving people something to see that they really wouldn't see anywhere else. They take pictures with their kids, they remember it, and it really becomes a neat sort of inspiring moment. Much the same way if you go to a baseball game, you remember the exciting parts, you don't remember the boring parts. So the zoo tries to do that as well and slip in some education along with the fun.
So on top of all of those great things that you have going on, you want to do more.
That's right.
You want the zoo to be even bigger. And it's because your 150th anniversary is coming
up. That's right. In 2025, we'll celebrate our 150th anniversary of being open. And, you know, in some ways, Michael, it's a Back to the Future campaign. The zoo's in the same park where it was built in 1875. But, of course, in the Victorian era, there weren't any cars. So all of the zoo was for animals and people. But as the 20th century came along, over 25% of the zoo became paved for parking. So what we've been doing for 25 years, believe it or not, is slowly, slowly taking parking lots and moving the cars out. That started with our Jungle Trails exhibit in 93. Of course, our big Africa exhibit where Fiona lives and the giraffes run, that used to be our main parking lot. And so now the final phase of pushing cars out is we're going to take the 5 acres that's now our safari parking lot, the lower back lot, And we're going to push those cars over to the south end of the zoo on the other side of the street near the VA. And that'll free up 5 acres for elephants. And we're calling it Elephant Trek. And that's made possible, most importantly, by the leadership gift of Harry and Linda Fath.
Yeah, they
launched this campaign.
$50 million.
They gave us $50 million to launch the campaign. And that really is a tribute to Harry Fath's leadership. He learned about our program and he said to himself, these folks will never get this off the ground if somebody doesn't say, we're going to do this, let's get going. And that's just what he did. And that will be exciting for us. It was a big decision. You know, people say the term go big or go home. With elephants today, that's really true. Our elephants at the zoo, we have 4, 3 cows and a bull. They're on about 1 acre of land. Now, that's more than they used to have 20 years ago. But it's not enough if you're going to have a larger herd, a multi-generational herd, and you're going to breed them. So the big 5 acre area will be enough for them. So we're going to move the cars out, put the elephants down there. But there's lots of other components to this campaign. We call it More Home to Roam because whether it's elephants or it's kangaroos or it's rhinos or it's polar bears, we do need to give our animals more space. And we've been doing that, but we're going to keep doing it.
So you're working on raising $150 million mm-hmm. in total. And is that on top of the $50 million, or does that include the $50
million? That includes the $50, and we're currently at a total of 62. As they say, the last 88 is the hardest, but we're getting there.
That is what they say. I know those phrases well in public radio.
Exactly. But there's a fun side to it, too. When Harry and Linda Fath gave that money, I know they perceived it as a match or a challenge like you guys do on the radio. So we are reaching out not just to folks who could be big donors, but also to the general public, getting the word out on shows such as this to say, listen, not everybody can write a giant check, but everybody could write a small check and support this. And so we're asking all our members, we have a huge membership base, over 70,000 families, and asking all sorts of folks in the community to consider even giving a modest amount of, say, $150 a year for 5 years. But again, if a big percentage of our 70,000 families gave $500, that mounts up.
And so with this money, this big expansion is taking place. You referenced the Elephant Trek. That's expected to open, according to like an earlier news release, mm-hmm. in about 2025.
Right.
But before that, you got a couple of things listed that would start in 2020. One, you would do something with your entry village.
That's right. If you come to the zoo right now, you'll see the 2 first projects underway. We do most of our construction in the winter because attendance is very slow in January and February. We are creating an additional entrance. The reason for that is our quote-unquote new entrance that has the bridge over Vine Street opened 10 years ago, but it was built for 1 million visitors a year. We're now over 1.8 million. So we're going to have people come across a bridge from Erkenbrecher Avenue as well. It's a public safety thing to keep kids off the street, so that's important. That's beginning. That is going to eventually be a 3-story parking structure. That's an expensive thing to build. So that's not getting built yet, but we're putting in the parking, putting in the new walk-in entrance, and that will certainly open by 2020. Our first exhibit is underway as well, and it's called Rue Valley
for kangaroos. Yeah, I want to hear about Rue Valley. We're going down under in this expansion.
It's going to be neat. It is down under, and that is the lowest part of the area. It's down where we used to have Sumatran rhinos and Wildlife Canyon. But once the rhinos went back to Sumatra, not many people visited. So it will have big kangaroos, big red kangaroos that people will walk among. It'll also have little penguins, the smallest penguin in the world that comes from Australia and Tasmania.
Yeah, so there's I read about that and I thought that there are penguins in Australia that cohabitate with kangaroos.
Well, the kangaroos, of course, are on land. Kangaroos fill the same niche as white-tailed deer do here. But the penguins, of course, are in the ocean. But
okay. People
think of penguins only living in Antarctica,
yeah.
But that's the big ones, like in March of the Penguins.
Right.
These are little penguins. They stand less than a foot tall. They're about the size of a really small football. But we have 32 now. And when this new exhibit opens in the spring of 2020, it'll be a big glass front area, a lot like where Fiona swims, but it'll have over 50 penguins in it. That'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
There's some other fun characteristics to this exhibit. We're building inside the city the only adventure high ropes course, where you'll enter from a higher level and do all sorts of different stations on it while you're strapped in. It'll be safe but full of adventure. And it's the only one anywhere that part of it, not all of it, part of it is handicap access. So you'll be able to take a wheelchair and go not just along a little path up there, but one is almost like you're on a surfboard. The chair goes out onto a platform and then someone pulls, or you, if you can, pull yourself across, you know, open air while in a wheelchair. We'll have some other lower parts toward the ground also for handicap access. So we have a neat program at the zoo we call Zoo Access for All. We have a great partnership with Cincinnati Children's and UC Health that we're working on that. Zoos are for everybody, right? Not everything in the whole wide world is for everybody, but zoos are. Everybody that goes to Kroger, everybody that listens to WVXU goes to the zoo. Well, everybody means everybody, so we're trying to make it so we are more welcoming to people on the autism spectrum, more people with other developmental disabilities. And, you know, we're listening a lot to moms. Moms know what need to be done, and especially moms who have kids with challenges, they'll try to help us get there. So, you know, nothing's ever perfect, but if you try hard, you can make a difference.
Always good advice to listen to what moms have to say.
Yeah.
Before we get off the kangaroos, though, I mean, how close are we talking about getting to these things?
Oh, when, yeah, when, we'll when be right there. It'll be a path that people walk through. And there won't be a fence. They'll just be right there among us. There will have to be, you know, supervisors, zoo employees and staff in there as well. And, you know, we'll have to monitor them. If we get one that's a rogue kangaroo, we might have to give him time out. But that'll be a lot of fun between that and the penguins. And for people familiar with that low area of the zoo, we're also creating a path so you won't have to go up the stairs. Historically, the conundrum was you got all the way down there, and if you had a stroller or a wheelchair, you had to go all the way back. But in this way, you'll get right out. So that'll be fun.
In our last couple of minutes together, Thane, I want to ask you or give you the opportunity at least to brag a little more about the zoo, because you're the greenest zoo in America.
We are considered that. We get a lot of national press, and I grinned when you said it because my colleagues from the West Coast who run the Seattle Zoo and the Portland Zoo and the San Francisco Zoo give me grief, man. When I see them at a zoo meeting, like, would you stop saying that? Because they're bored. And, of course, their local press says, what the heck? Those people are in the Rust Belt. They didn't even know what green is. To which we say, well, show us what you got, because I'm telling you, we do it. Ours is a tribute to this, how one individual can make a difference. In 2006, we hired a civil engineer from Turner Construction named Mark Fisher. He was hired to run our facilities, help build the new buildings. But engineers measure things. And he said, man, we are wasting water. We are wasting energy. And we got to do this smarter. And I'll tell you what. If you look at your water bill, it's going up like a J curve everywhere because we have an old system and we have to all chip in to pay to upgrade it. Well, when you use as much water as the zoo does, that's very expensive. So we went from being the biggest user and biggest waster of water in the Metropolitan Sewer District to today we use only 1/6 the amount of tap water that we used 12 years ago. The answer of how we do that, even though the zoo's much bigger, is we catch rainwater, huge quantities of rainwater under our parking, under our exhibits, and then we can use that water, like, for instance, Fiona swims in rainwater, and we irrigate with rainwater, et cetera. And it's just doing things smarter. That's actually how we're going to solve complex issues like climate change, is by everybody little by little saying, I don't want to waste energy and water and resources like we did 100 years ago. I want to do it smart.
So take that, Seattle.
Ah,
I didn't realize there were these little gang rivalries in the zoo world.
I used to live in Seattle. The coasts are snobby as can be about the middle of the country. They're like, oh, God, I can't believe you live in Ohio. You know, that kind of thing.
Well, we wish you the best, and we certainly wish you the best with that last $88 million you've got to raise. If people want to help out, where can they go?
On our zoo website, there's a button you can click to contribute. They're also welcome to reach specifically out to me, and I can explain more about what we're doing. And Michael, it's not just about bricks and mortar. It is about the mission of what the zoo does. We bring it every day. We're committed to being good partners in the community. We work with a variety of churches and programs in Avondale because that's the home of the Cincinnati Zoo. And I think this town's proud of its zoo, and I think there are good reasons.
Thane Maynard is the director of the Cincinnati Zoo. Appreciate you coming down and talking to us.
Thank you. Good to meet you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks.